When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. PostWrestlingCafe.com. $6 gets you in the door.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Welcome, everyone, to the latest edition of Pollock and Thurston. I'm John Pollock, along with Brandon Thurston, and here we go on a Wednesday afternoon, and I'm ready to go. Are you all set, Brandon?
I'm ready as I'll ever be.
The answer I was looking for. We have a lot to discuss on today's show. We've got a returning champion here on Pollock and Thurston, Kareem Zidane, journalist extraordinaire. He will be joining us at the bottom of the hour as we discuss everything from the promotion of John Cena versus CM Punk to Zuffa boxing to conflict in the Middle East. I think we will cover it all in this discussion with Kareem Zidane as WWE returns to Saudi Arabia. Was there ever a thought in your mind, Brandon, that this venture over to Saudi Arabia could ever have been a doubt over the bombs dropped by the U.S. in Iran? Did you ever think that there would be a pause to this tour coming up this weekend?
Not likely. If things escalated, which according to the news that I follow has not happened yet, there were some shots taken at the base, the U.S. military base in Qatar. There are, I believe, bases in Saudi Arabia. Maybe that could have happened, but that has not happened. So I think it's going to happen. And my impression was, Saudi Arabia is not Iran, is not Israel. And there were some airlines, right, that canceled flights, but it's not like, I don't believe the airspace over Saudi Arabia was shut down at any point.
There were some restrictions in the northern part of Saudi Arabia, after, Donald Trump had announced this ceasefire. There were several follow-up strikes by both Israel and Iran, to which Saudi Arabia did condemn Iran for those strikes. But it does feel as though we have at least a temporary ceasefire, that there have been no immediate strikes in the aftermath, that I don't think this ever crossed the threshold where I felt that there was going to be some WWE, hitting the escape valve on this set of shows that they have coming up, because they are off today to do SmackDown Friday and Night of Champions Saturday.
Yes. And there are reports that some staff members might have been stranded in airports and in the course of traveling over there. But I understand it's been reported today that that talent now are leaving today to go towards Saudi Arabia. In other political news, did you know that Buffalo elected maybe a new mayor yesterday?
Is this the the big Democratic primary that you are referencing.
Yes. Yes, it is. Sean Ryan has won the Democratic primary, much like there is a New York primary happening here. Byron Brown, he is now working for OTB. Do you know about that whole story? Our former mayor is now working for Off-Track Betting.
Oh, is he? Well,
after
congratulations.
He was the longest reigning mayor in Buffalo history, which is saying a lot.
Is that a scandal in Buffalo, or is that just par for the course?
That's par for the course for Byron Brown. Yes.
If anyone wants to know our Toronto's contributions to the political zeitgeist, you can go watch, just recently released on Netflix, a whole documentary on Rob Ford, the now deceased former yes. mayor of Toronto, who was...
Is this the guy who did crack?
Yes. Okay. Yes. This was our crack-smoking mayor who did a lot of other stuff as well. Quite the fascinating look back at a very turbulent time in Toronto's history that... I came out of that period deciding that I am going to vote for the most boring candidate every time out. I want a mayor that I never even hear about afterward. To mixing degrees, we've had scandal with other mayors, but not to the degree of Rob Ford. That was really our imprint on the political world back a decade ago.
Okay.
But you know what? While you do bring this up, the New York primary that did go down on Tuesday, a bit of a upset here, as Zoran Mamdani won the Democratic primary. Now, Pollock, why are you talking about New York politics here? Well, leave it up to professional wrestling fans to find footage of Mamdani attending Grand Slam at Arthur Ashe Stadium in 2021, sitting among the people, a confirmed wrestling fan and a socialist Democratic leader here that will now be running against Eric Adams for the mayoral position in New York.
And this is, so we're looking at this now. This is his, this is him sitting here. That's him right there, I guess.
Yes. Just okay. In awe of Kenny Omega and Brian Danielson and, okay. You know, sitting like way up there. I wonder if he was maybe taking pictures for WrestleTix.
I hope he was. Yeah. Everyone should take pictures for WrestleTix and send them.
What are the chances we can get this guy on the show? I think there's I think maybe today a lot harder. I would say our time was 2 weeks ago if yes. we had known this. I think he would have done any and all media.
He would have needed to appeal to the Canadian portion of the election.
All we would have to say, Brandon Thurston, citizen of the state of New York, would like to have you on his wildly successful pro wrestling podcast. But anyway, there you go. That's our wrestling connection to the to the run for the next mayor of New York, as I don't imagine Eric Adams is going to be in a prime standing.
Oh, he's still running. He's going to be on the independent.
Oh, I know. I'm just I don't know. It sounds like this guy is as popular as they come amongst the constituents, both left and right in mm-hmm. New York. So we will put a pause on the finally. WWE Saudi Arabia discussion because
more politics to come. Don't worry.
Yeah, lots more. Okay, plenty of fuel for your angry comments and tweets afterwards. But let's move on to some of your reporting from earlier this week, Brandon. The Janelle Grant case continues against WWE and Vince McMahon. John Laurinaitis removing himself, running for cover in this case. But now Grant's legal team is requesting a series of documents, communications from various members of the McMahon family, NDA drafts, board of directors communications. They're going for a wide range as they try to initiate the discovery phase. But what, if you can be a bit specific, Brandon, what are they looking for here and what is the process that they're now going through?
So this is related, this is supposed to be only related to, this is what's called motion-related discovery. The issue at hand, as we've talked about for a number of weeks right now, is arbitration. They're fighting about whether this arbitration clause that's part of the $3 million NDA should be enforced or not, stay in public court or go away to private arbitration. And the judge allowed her to request, allowed Janelle Grant to request discovery evidence related to that question. So this is what she has requested. The filing also notes that these parties, the defendants and the plaintiff attorneys, met the prior Friday and could not come to an agreement, no surprise, about what kind of discovery would be allowed to be disclosed. So she's requesting a lot of things that are related to the NDA, documents sufficient to show the identity of each individual who participated in the drafting, communications between WWE or Vince McMahon related to this, all drafts of the NDA, also Ms. Grant's complete employment file at WWE, which she's also requesting, as you mentioned, all board materials from January 1st, 2019 to January 30th, 2025, all minutes of board audit committee, minutes of the board audit committee from the same time period, all documents of communications between the defendants on one hand and an Endeavor and the other concerning the disclosure of litigation liabilities from 2019 to 2023. What I'm getting at is I think there's going to be some pushback, and they're going to be allowed to file their pushback. The defendants will next Monday. So this was expected. This was the deadline this past Monday when this was filed, and the deadline for the defendants to say we oppose these discovery requests is going to be this coming Monday, where I imagine maybe among other things they're going to say this is not these requests that you're making are not related to the arbitration issue. We've seen minutes related to these board meetings become a part of the shareholder lawsuit that is in the Delaware Court of Chancery, which we've been following on and off as developments have come out of that most recently. So it looks like some similar evidence. What the plaintiffs have also said, what Grant's attorneys have also said, is that all of this evidence has already been checked over for privilege. It's already been disclosed as part of the SDNY potential criminal case, which has resulted in no charges to date. It could all be provided immediately. It's all ready to go. You don't have to delay and drag your feet on this.
So the expectation will be that WWE and Vince McMahon are going to oppose this. And what is this ultimately in the hands of Sarah Russell to determine like what the next step of this is? Because it seems a foregone conclusion that there will be opposition to all of these requests, or at least most of them.
Yes. And they're also asking for a delay on the motions that Grant would have to make. They want all the discovery before she has to say this is why it shouldn't go to arbitration. But yes, it'll be up to the judge, Sarah F. Russell. Grant is also requesting all communications between Linda McMahon and Vince McMahon, all communications between Dr. Kolker and Vince McMahon and WWE. Something I mentioned, I think, last week is that between this and what we've talked about before, the case against Dr. Kolker, the petition for bill of discovery at the state level, this could all result in her getting quite a bit of evidence and then maybe getting sent to arbitration, but still having a lot of discovery that's part of the public record, presumably by then, if that's what happens. One of the big challenges of discovery arbitration, especially for a plaintiff, is that there's little to no discovery that you can do because you don't have a court to order people to hand stuff over.
Well, we will await what the response is from Vince McMahon and WWE. Maybe they'll say, great idea. You've made it very specific. Here are all of the documents. Does that have a 1% chance of occurring?
Unlikely. And we did get a comment from Grant's representatives noting that W. McMahon had the opportunity to voluntarily provide discovery and they refused. That's referring again to the meeting that the attorneys had on Friday, and the defendants did not volunteer any information, or did not without having the court get involved, agree to provide anything.
Yeah, the statement that they provided to us at Post Wrestling as well goes on to say they claim the NDA and its arbitration clause are enforceable, but resist any attempts to investigate whether Ms. Grant was coerced into signing it. Facts that go to the heart of its enforceability. They can't have it both ways. Today we ask the court to allow that discovery to proceed. Ms. Grant deserves to have the facts about her case. So that can be read up at postwrestling.com with an in-depth breakdown from Brandon Thurston.
And just to add, at this point, it could be more substantive when she does file her opposition to their motions for arbitration. But so far, she's just saying that Grant was under duress, and that's why this NDA should not be validated. The NDA was also, they're saying, part of criminal activity, which they're saying that based on the appeals court ruling that we have, where the appeals court, as a result of the SDNY potential criminal case, the appeals court reviewed this ruling from the lower SDNY court that said, oh yeah, this communication that Vince McMahon and likely Jerry McDivitt had, that was not subject to attorney-client privilege because there was what's called the crime fraud investigation. It looks like you were doing something illegal here, so you don't get attorney-client privilege for that. So again, Grant is saying that this was done in the course of criminal activity. Again, nobody's been charged with any crimes. However, that's what they're saying so far.
Over the past week, Stephanie McMahon put out her latest podcast, and her guest was Nick Khan. Great guest coordination on part of a What Is Your Story by Stephanie McMahon.
And Stephanie McMahon or Steph McMahon?
Yeah, this is interesting because the branding is Steph McMahon, although yes. I feel she is constantly referred to as Stephanie on this show. So, I mean, that is up for interpretation. We are going to go with Stephanie. Is that a unanimous decision on our part, or should we cut it in half?
That's fine.
Okay. Here is Nick Khan and Stephanie McMahon and the topic of Vince McMahon being brought up.
My dad tells the story that he was oftentimes beaten by various boyfriends, etc., that were with his mom. He grew up in a trailer park, and he would always stand up for his mom, and he would take these beatings. And one time he tells the story that he was beaten with a lead pipe and left in a ditch to die. But his mindset was, if he could survive, he won. So just surviving was winning and still is winning for him today. And I don't know how you can ever beat someone at the end of the day if all they need to do is survive to win.
The first time I ever read that, he had done an interview in the late 90s with a publication that had great interviews. And he
Playboy.
Talked,
yes, yeah.
He talked about that. He talked about abuse he had suffered at the hands of one of his parents,
of
not his
mother.
Father. Yes.
Yeah.
To recover, to move on, to go from trailer park to, you know,
billionaire
all of the success.
Yeah.
There's not many people.
And created
who can say that. An empire. A universe.
Yes, absolutely.
Correct. A universe. Yeah. So all credit to him. I only have admiration for him. You know, as Paul said, Triple H said at his Hall of Fame speech, family's complicated. And, you know, obviously we don't need to get into any of that.
Yeah, we're not going any deeper on that. But
in terms of business, that guy's an empire builder.
Absolutely he is.
Nothing.
And no
respect.
One can take that away from him.
Nobody.
No matter what.
Yep.
Including himself, who is probably his biggest nemesis is himself.
I thought we weren't getting into that.
We're not.
Okay, perfect.
Well, there you go. Some interesting comments here. And the image that came to mind as well, like hearing that story about them, was going back to the match that Vince McMahon and Stephanie had, if you remember this, in 2003, where they beat each other with a lead pipe.
Yes. I forget the pay-per-view. Summer?
This was No Mercy.
Or so? No
this
mercy.
Was No Mercy, and I believe this was a week out from Stephanie's wedding. That was the story, was that Vince could not rough up Stephanie because her wedding was the next week. But yes, this was a... Anyway, that connects everything together here. But were you surprised at all that they even discussed, even as little as they did, about Vince McMahon in this setting as well, that they would, even if this topic came up, of ultimately keeping it in the final version of this interview? Or do you feel it's not as big of a deal for them to at least address the existence of Vince McMahon? Because it's been a different philosophy when it comes to WWE programming, where they have avoided and edited around Vince to great degree.
It's the president of the company sitting here, so if he didn't tell them to take it out, I mean, he knows what was in it. It's not like it's going to surprise him. Nick Khan says, I have nothing but admiration for Vince McMahon, which I don't know that that's the greatest PR message to send when is he just talking about his business acumen in that? You could just read it as that. And that's what people said. Oh, he's just talking about what a great businessman he was, how successful he was. Every sign I get from Nick Khan in the ways that he's talked about Vince, whether it was January 2023, after he's forced his way back into the company, whether it's on Pat McAfee's show, you know, weeks before the General Grant lawsuit is filed, where they're talking in glowing terms about Vince McMahon, or now, it sure sounds like he's one of these people who's standing by Vince and still feels a great deal of affinity for him. We don't know. And this is the same guy who's hired Lee Fitting after he left ESPN now, amid sexual misconduct allegations. He's somebody who likely hired Jamie Horowitz over from when he was fired from Fox Sports amid sexual harassment allegations. It just points
these
to
these are instances where these, and they're all different cases and degrees of you know, there's different degrees of such, but like the hiring process has shown these are not career enders, or at least for Nick Khan, who speaks about loyalty in this episode, is that, you know, his people are his people, and these are not ultimately, you know, I think it's been very clear in Nick Khan's outward descriptions of Vince McMahon, what his appeal is on a Vince McMahon. Would he consider Vince McMahon a friend? I would think yes. I think he definitely would.
It may sound like a naive question to ask about the leader of a major subsidiary of a publicly traded company, but I just don't see where are the principles? Where is the line that is too far?
And there isn't one, Brandon. Like there really isn't. And the demarcation line is, to me, in this company, in the culture of TKO, it's one thing when we're talking about businesses with being in business with foreign governments, with you know, a lot of human rights violations. But once it's in house and you've got a video of your UFC CEO slapping his wife, that to me was the line that was like, how can you speak out against this stuff when that was something that not only was Dana White able to retain his position, went without any punishment, went without any public statement by the UFC that condemned this action or that this is something that they do not promote. You know, they've got a fighter on their undercard of UFC 317 this weekend who is facing like significant charges and has like this guy is accused of breaking into his ex-girlfriend's house, ripping like jewelry off her fingers, and they have booked this guy for a prelim fight this weekend. Like, it does tell you, like, this stuff is not disqualifying, and it runs the gamut from whether you are the top of the chain like a Dana White or you're literally in the opening prelim fight on a UFC card. Those to me are not you know, principled stances that they are taking, even ones that would have no blowback, such as not booking a fighter who's caught an enormous criminal record and pending charges.
The only real principle I know is the stock price, which is doing quite well, which is, you know, about to show this image where it's up 64% in the last 365 days. He could certainly have said something like, you know, he had great successes as a businessman. He built this company, and not to go so far as to say, I have nothing but admiration for him, which leads you to think that, oh, including all the allegations that we've heard about for the last 2-3 years, he has great, that does not dissuade his admiration for him. Stephanie was more challenging of her father than he was here.
Stephanie made no indication of, like, she could have danced around it and said that, you know, everyone, there's two sides to every story. She could have stated the fact that, you know, everyone gets their day in court. He is not, like, she didn't run any defense for her father. If anything, like, she volunteered this, like, that he can be his own nemesis in many cases. I thought that, you know, Stephanie was, neither of them, I would say, were necessarily transparent in this exchange, but enough that you could certainly read between the lines here of what you would think their attitudes towards Vince McMahon are in present day.
Yeah. I guess it makes me think, you know, this is why these stories continue to require such coverage and should be highlighted and should be asked about, because I don't know if this company's really changing. Now, I'm sure, If any part of the allegations against Vince McMahon are true, I don't have reason to believe that anything like that is still happening at the company. But why couldn't it? If you know, there seems to be a complacency or an accommodation for it.
Would you ever accept a loan from Nick Khan?
I think that would be a bad idea, as someone who reports on WWE.
So whatever loans I've given, everyone's repaid them.
But you never expected the money back?
Never. Never mention it. Never expect it, never even really want it back. And what I'll say to them, they're usually younger people who are struggling, or sometimes, you know, older people who you've been close to for a long time. I'll say, hey, listen, it's between you and me. There's no interest on it. Don't tell anybody. If you have the means to pay it back, pay it back. If you don't, no problem. But if you have the means to pay it back and you don't, just know that I'll remember it. And they've all paid it back. And that's a credit to them.
So here you go.
Who's he giving loans to?
people that are, you know, in need of a helping hand. But I mean, if that wouldn't give you a bit of a pause that, hey, if you have the means to pay it back and you don't, just know I'll remember it.
I mean, make you an offer you can't refuse.
Yeah, but no interest. No interest on these loans. Yeah. So anyway, did you get through most of this interview or did you seek out an hour and 40 minutes of stuff?
I did not spend an hour and 40 minutes listening to this.
There are ways around that, you know, in this.
Yes. 2XB done now.
You can get through this in a lot quicker fashion. But there you go. That was Nick Khan, a rare interview these days. Not a man that is too front and center all the time. That seems to be, not to the degree he was, I would say, in years past, but making an exception for Stephanie McMahon.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Save big money on everything for your projects now at Menards. Plastic lattice panels are durable, low maintenance, and are easy to install. They're a great accent for deck skirting, garden trellises, and creating privacy walls. We stock a huge variety of colors and sizes to fit your project. Save big on lattice at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chalk Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. That's chop-tees.com/post-wrestling.
All right, let's go through a few other things here. We have a couple of minutes here before we are joined by our guest, Tony Khan. Was at over in France for the Cannes Film Festival and sat down with Yahoo Finance and did an interview that got a bunch of attention. So here is Tony Khan talking about AEW's performance on cable since streaming on Max at the beginning of the year.
Feels like 2025 is, in a lot of ways, the best year we've had. I mean, we're having a great...
Well, how big is the business? How many sales do you... bring in? I mean, is it making money? Like, what do you?
Yeah, we're doing
like?
Fantastic. This was a huge year for us. We grew the business so much with the simulcast.
Gotcha.
We brought in new audience with Max and streaming, but also we've been able to grow our cable audience year over year. Frankly, that cable and satellite and
growth
stream,
of cable. Who's doing that?
Well, you know, honestly, us, because a lot of people thought when you start simulcasting AEW on Wednesday nights and Saturday nights, oh, okay, well, a lot of people, they're still going to watch the show, but people are going to migrate to streaming. Well, actually, our cable audience, when we started simulcasting, went up, and we have a great audience on Max streaming every week, too. So we have been able to do that, and we've really maintained and grown a great audience over the years. AEW, we say it's where the best wrestle, and I really believe that's true. I think we have the best roster of wrestlers in the world.
That was Tony Khan talking about AEW's performance on cable up year over year. Question mark.
Well,
You tell us, Brandon. He said year over year.
Year over year. What does that mean? We can parse that in a moment. So Dynamite is down year over year in total viewership by about 20%. This is from a week ago, but 1 week isn't going to change it greatly. What about the demo? The demo is down like 37%. But what about Collision? Yeah, Collision's down about 26%. What about Collision? That was in the demo. What about total viewership? It's down 17%. So there's really no way that what he's saying could be true. Now it's true that in the end of Q4, right when the simulcast started, viewership didn't immediately decline. There's no evidence that, like, oh, there was this big cannibalization effect that resulted from, you know, people having the option to watch on Max, that they moved from TBS or TNT to watch it on Max. There's no evidence of that suggests there was at least immediate cannibalization. But to say it's up year over year, unless you have some definition of year over year that the Merriam-Webster dictionary does not agree with, then it's not true that cable viewership is up. Now, is with the addition of Max viewership, is viewership up if you include that? Maybe, but I don't know. We don't have any data on that, and I question if he's got data on that.
like the max streaming viewership. Obviously, that's a major caveat to all of this. You know, in terms, if you are just looking at present performance for AEW for the year, if we're looking at, you know, as we're coming up to halfway through 2025, is AEW, what is their performance relative to the fourth quarter of last year when it did feel like this was a bottoming out period for AEW from a lot of different factors?
Yes. And so I was doing some research to look at, you know, I think what people, especially AEW fans, probably want to talk about is and would you say from watching the show that since the new year, the product feels different significantly?
Yes.
Compared to 2024?
Yeah. Yes, I would.
Yeah. And if you're a big AEW fan, you might want to say, well, I feel that way too. And that has to be resulting in the increase of popularity across the brand, across all the metrics. We've kind of talked about this in earlier weeks. So I decided let's really take a look at it. And I looked at, well, let's look at the rank. That's the thing that compares Dynamite to the performance of TV generally. And we do see this rank. I've got this broken out by weekly ranking for Dynamite and P18 and 409, which is data that we get from Programming Insider. And we do see in the second half of Q2 or so, it is climbing. And if we look at just the straightforward viewership, we do see since the end of the year, it's climbing a little bit despite max viewership. Is it up year over year? No, because as you can see back in 2024, it was much higher throughout the year. Is it at the level it was at in 2023? Certainly not. But it does seem to be climbing. Now, what about attendance that is not affected by all these new forms of media? And attendance even, and we're not even including the Arena Mexico attendance, whatever that was, whether it was 14,000, whatever it was. Dynamite attendance in most of this new year and through the present, this is a mathematical upward slope that I could draw here. And this is not just one metric. It's not just one splicing of data, but this is across TV and attendance in different ways of looking at it. That's a preponderance. That's at least three things. And that is moving in the right direction. Boom period, no. As popular as it was a year ago, probably not. But moving in the right direction, which is not something you could say until roughly now.
And something that was hard to fathom as 2024 was coming to an end, and it just felt as though both companies were going in opposite directions, and it seems as though, you know, WWE has certainly not curtailed, at least attendance-wise. We can look at other factors like Netflix, for instance, but overall, it does feel as though there is a lot more momentum on AEW's side, but I think that has to be tempered. We are not talking about them turning the clock back to 2022, no. Or, as you said, even a year ago.
Yes, and let's be fair to Tony Khan. He may not know what his ratings are year over year. But, you know, as the year was ending last year, I think it was, you know, I was saying, I think somebody else should be in charge of creative, because I just don't know of any moment in history where the same person in charge of creative has overseen a decline in popularity metrics like we're seeing here and then been able to turn it around. And this is not recovered, but moving in the right direction.
All right. We are going to change our focus back to the WWE's return to Saudi Arabia, which is coming up this Friday and Saturday, and it's going to be headlined at Night of Champions by John Cena and CM Punk with one of the more interesting promotional devices that they have used, incorporating Saudi Arabia into CM Punk being forced that if he wants this title shot, he has got to go to Saudi Arabia.
Match like this, you're going to follow me to Saudi Arabia. And we're going to do it at Night of Champions. Ball's in your court, hero. I use CM Punk's rebellious nature and sociopathic self-confidence to back him into a corner. Where now, if CM Punk really wants to take this, he has to admit to himself that he's a hypocrite.
That is John Cena in the lead up to Night of Champions, and we welcome back to Pollock and Thurston, Kareem Zidane. Kareem, I don't know how much WWE programming you are taking in these days, but to give you a refresher, back in January of 2020, when CM Punk was still with AEW, he fired off this now very famous, since deleted tweet in response to The Miz, telling him to, quote, "Go suck a blood money covered dick in Saudi Arabia, you fucking dork." This was subsequently deleted, and now, since CM Punk has come back to WWE beginning in 2023, he has never gone on one of these shows in Saudi Arabia until this weekend, and a lot of his fan base has pushed back on this of, you know, not just the fact that there was almost an inevitability Punk would have to do one of these shows, but that the WWE has turned this into a portion of the story, almost presenting Saudi Arabia as this compromising territory that Punk has to overcome his hypocrisy to get this title match. And it is, to me, more so surprising that WWE would opt to go in this direction on screen.
Honestly, I was a bit shocked, John. And it's funny, I don't really watch Monday Night Raw week to week, but occasionally, since it's on Netflix now especially, if I happen to be sitting in front of the TV, I'll put it on. And I did turn it on that week for that interview, for that promo. And I was really, really surprised that they were heading in that direction. It seems to me that at this point, this relationship has been so, so heavily normalized that they're able to make it part of storyline. What's a bit odd here is that they're almost goading CM Punk and sort of playing off his character and sort of weakening his presentation, really, in many ways, by using the Saudi connection without actually saying, you know, Saudi Arabia or what CM Punk himself had done with that tweet that he wrote. It's just such an odd situation. I'm not 100% sure what their payoff is supposed to be. Is CM Punk supposed to be victorious? I don't think so. Against John Cena, what's going to happen here that makes this so worthwhile? And what exactly are they drawing attention to? Is it the fact that, you know, CM Punk took a legitimate moral stance against Saudi Arabia and now he has to break it? Well, are you trying to say that, oh, well, this is the organization where nobody's moral and we have no morals? What is the point here? I don't quite understand. All that I see here is that this relationship has been heavily normalized and that nobody has any issue with sort of pointing out and really showcasing the fact that you're heading back to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I think it raises a lot of questions about what the ultimate intent is for, because I mean, I don't think there's any squaring away that they have positioned it that, you know, in fashion, like the CM Punk character has had no rebuttal to this, no explanation, nothing. I mean, they could save that for Friday when the show is in Riyadh. But it really does, to me, I think it is, there are a lot of, I think, wrestling characters that fans can take or leave when it comes to, like, quote unquote authenticity, but Punk is one of those few that I think his audience is going to have the most disappointment, I would say, in someone that had this stand and there's been no kind of explanation other than what Cena has claimed in storyline is kind of how things are playing out in reality. And I think the reaction Punk receives this weekend will also be interesting if they just see him as a big star coming over for the first time, or if they're in tune enough that they're aware of like what the subtext or just the outright language has been in the promotion.
I honestly think that CM Punk will be embraced in Saudi Arabia, assuming he comes out and it's a completely normal entrance, etc., an event. I think he's going to be embraced. Why? Because you're going to be happy that he chose to come in the end, that he didn't continue to hold this stance. And I think when we talk about this normalization, I want people to really understand what someone like CM Punk is up against at this very moment. When everybody at this point is going to Saudi Arabia, he almost has no legs to stand on at this point. What are you really going to say? Well, there's, you know, anybody moral, anybody who has, you know, any guts would not go to Saudi. Well, everybody is going. Everybody's going to get that bag, as they say. Now, what makes him so special? What makes him different? And what stance is he actually taking at this point by not going to Saudi Arabia. And I bet all those thoughts are going through his head, and that's the kind of pressure you will face when literally everything around you is going to Saudi Arabia, right? So it just doesn't surprise me. We've even seen this, and this jumping ahead a little bit, but we've seen this with Ari Emanuel. Ari Emanuel was one of the few businessmen. This is the guy who runs TKO now, owns this thing. And this was one of the few businessmen in the United States who decided that he was so appalled by the decapitation of Jamal Khashoggi that he wanted to return Saudi Arabia's public investment fund investment into his company, into Endeavor. And he actually returned those funds, which is just unheard of. Like, most of Hollywood did not do that at the time. So when TKO was formed and the UFC and Endeavor purchased the WWE, I immediately wrote a piece at the time saying that it's only a matter of time before the UFC and Endeavor strengthen their ties with Saudi Arabia. Much has changed since then. This normalization process over the past few years has really cemented the kingdom as a global platform for the world of sports. And it's unavoidable, sports and entertainment at this point. And, you know, lo and behold, it's exactly what happened with Emanuel, right? The UFC started going to Saudi Arabia and partnering with them. And at the same time, we're seeing the formation of Zuffa Boxing, right? So if you've got these major businessmen right now who clearly had just, you know, more media attention than, say, a CM Punk, you know, admitting that, oh, they made a mistake, at least professionally made a mistake, and were willing to backtrack, again, who is CM Punk in comparison to all these people to take a stance? And this is not me defending him or attacking him. I'm just trying to sort of present this type of international pressure that happens now. It goes both ways.
So the wrestlers who did not go originally have all gone back, as you said, with Sami exactly. Zayn originally not going, Kevin Owens, even John Cena himself would not go after the first event. Mm-hmm. Brian Danielson as well, and now they've all gone back. I guess
Danielson has not gone back, but that's just
because
he did the first show, but I mean he's also left the company mm-hmm. during that time.
Yeah, I mean, like, if would you suggest that WWE talent would achieve something, or should they like refuse to not go, or is there anything that they should do to try to push back against the company being involved in this? Is there anything that's practical, or it what is, should somebody in that situation do?
It's a very, very difficult situation. Honestly, listen, I'll speak from my work. I've never called on people, despite the fact that I've spent most of my career really raising these concerns, investigative pieces and whatnot, talking about the human rights issues in Saudi. I've never called on people to boycott, to not visit the country, not do any of that. What I really care for is for people to have that awareness, to not create this world of sort of willful ignorance where you're making excuses for yourself and for others. And there's a way where WWE performers can go to Saudi Arabia while still raising concerns, right? Once upon a time, Lewis Hamilton, famous F1 racer, when he went to Bahrain back in the day, one of the things he did was went and met with Bahraini officials and raised the topic of human rights in Bahrain. This in itself is, we can say, problematic, because he now is backing a F1 race in Rwanda, where there's a dictator there as well, in Paul Kagame, who treats his own people horribly. So nobody's perfect, but there are ways to take stances here. And I still think that there are things WWE performers could do in Saudi Arabia to, let's say, pressure the government to at least take some sort of superficial action. Because at this point, there's really no resistance whatsoever. And in some ways, it's quite jarring to see. I mean, I remember writing a piece sometime last year for one of the events in Saudi Arabia. I can't remember which of the two it was at the time. But sort of the female talent had taken this picture at one of the private beaches in Saudi Arabia. And they were full on in their bikinis, etc. And I was thinking to myself, well, it's great that the foreigners can come to Saudi and do that. But how many of Saudi Arabia's own population can actually do that? So these are things that are important to raise awareness for, because I unfortunately think that a lot of these wrestlers that go and they have their personal experiences, which is they see these fantastic hotels and this lovely pristine location and say, hey, life is great here. But they don't actually know what's going on. And it's not that hard to speak to people, to speak to activists, to speak to officials, to speak to the people there around you, and to bring that conversation back to the United States. That's the best you can do at this point.
And I think you also go to, you know, sometimes it becomes very difficult when you are within this machine and this is part of the job and the day-to-day things. And, you know, world geopolitics is not necessarily what they have signed up for, mm-hmm. but it does become a much more real situation when it is directly impacting yourself. And there are a couple of performers on this weekend show that were on the tour back in 2019 when there was a holdup with the flight getting out of Saudi Arabia. Like, that was a real issue. You had family members online very concerned about their partners that were over there. And we fast forward, and yes, we have this, you know, temporary ceasefire, but on Monday afternoon, you can't tell me that these performers, this staff, that there's not at least a concern about my safety going over there as well. And like, you didn't hear any issue of, you know, any kind of resistance or thought of, you know, what is required of me going on, you know, to the Middle East at a time when, you know, there was a lot of unrest over these last 2 weeks.
This is what happens when you make a deal with an entity, with a kingdom, actually, where the whole point of the project, this partnership, is a state-funded project that is supposed to be a form of propaganda that makes the kingdom look good, and you're being paid a ton of money for it. Now, there's a lot of conflicts here. There's a lot of incentive for you to go there, right? You owe it to this kingdom that's paying you an insane amount of money to continue to promote and present them. And especially this facade of stability that's trying to be presented there. If anything, they need that now more than ever at this point. So it's very hard for the WWE, I'm talking about the leadership here, to take this kind of decision and say, I'm sorry, we're backing out, because it makes them look bad. It makes Saudi Arabia look bad. And the truth is, John, there's been precedent for events like this to go forward despite the concerns. I'll give two scenarios here. First of all, right after the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, it was, what, 10 days later that the WWE went there? I understand there was no physical concern for the competitors at the time, but you're telling me nobody on staff was concerned that this was not a good idea to go back to, you know, Saudi Arabia at this point and maybe work with Mohammed bin Salman at all, you know, the guy with the bone saw? So beyond that, what about the fact that in 2022, when Saudi Arabia first started hosting the F1 Grand Prix in Jeddah, one of the first things that happened was while there was a practice race and you've got the drivers on the track, the Houthis actually bomb through a drone strike one of the oil facilities that was nearby. From the pictures, you can still see these pictures on Getty and all sorts of things online. The drivers are on the racetrack and there's plumes of smoke in the background. F1 and Saudi Arabia still decide to go ahead with the race, what, the next day or 2 days later? I mean, it will take something special to cancel these events. And maybe had the fight had this, you know, war still been ongoing and this very, very fragile ceasefire not been agreed to, I'd say it was very possible that this wouldn't happen simply because the logistics make it impossible. Flights were being canceled to the Gulf from everywhere. I'd say from my native Egypt, for instance, you can't go to the Gulf right now. There are our main airline, Egypt Air, won't fly to the Gulf right now. So there was that's the only scenario that was going to stop the WWE from actually going there. It was going to be that level of logistical issues and problems.
One question we get oftentimes when we talk about this, and I don't think we've ever talked about it with you, Kareem, is so we have this question here from a listener saying, on propaganda projects, the U.S. has committed global atrocities for years and gotten away with it due to its cultural hegemony. They're treated like Russia. Will U.S. propaganda ever be called out as we do with Saudi Arabia? So we have people who will often say, well, how can you be critical? Isn't it hypocritical to say, look at this terrible event that WWE is doing with this horrible regime, when you're saying that, like I am, from the United States?
Okay, this is an excellent question. And I was hoping to raise this topic anyway at some point in this conversation, but I'm glad this listener brought up this question. So let me start by saying this. First of all, it's becoming very, very, very difficult to do the type of work we do without having this question raised, because look what's happening in the United States. And honestly, look at the atrocities the U.S. has been causing as a global hegemon for decades now, from regime changes to wars to mass atrocities and war crimes. The list goes on, right? The underlying thing that made the U.S. apparently different once upon a time was this element of democracy, this idea that there were checks and balances and ways to resist and to respond. The fact that we still had free speech, free press, and ways to resist, fight back, whatever you want to call it. That is disappearing under Donald Trump in particular, right? This creeping authoritarianism in the United States, the mass deportations of people, the you know, the complete, you know, mispractice of justice. All the list really goes on. You know, bombing Iran outside of international law, violating international laws in general. It is as important to write about the states and to call out the human rights, the human rights abuses in the United States as it is anywhere else at this point. That's something I do. I write about the, as a matter of fact, I write about Trump, I think, more than I write about any other world leader to this point. I think it's because it's this important to do so. You can't address these issues without, if we're talking about the influence of sports and politics, and especially in the world of combat sports, Donald Trump is an essential part of this. And his partnership with the UFC has helped to reshape the United States, both its culture, its society, and its politics, right? It's an impossible topic to avoid, and I have no interest in avoiding it. But with that being said, that doesn't make the crimes committed by other regimes any less important to cover. It is just as important to give all these entities that much attention. And that's what I intend to do, because to me, the topic of human rights is not a partisan issue. It's not something that we should be discussing as in which politics am I, whose side am I on this very specific topic. Similar to, say, the trans rights debates right now. People take it from a left versus right angle, and which side do I fall on depending on which political side I'm already on. That's a horrible way to approach human beings and legitimate issues that require empathy. Empathy is not political. And that's how I view concept of human rights. I will write about Qatar and Saudi and Egypt. I'll write about Russia. I'll write about Cambodia. I'll write about Rwanda. I'll write about the United States. I'll write about Canada. As a matter of fact, it was only a few days ago that I published an article. Well, it was really half an article that also connected to my Guardian piece I did in 2022, which was right after the FIFA World Cup at the time, where I implored my colleagues, my fellow journalists, my fellow sports reporters, that I'm glad that you had this sort of zeal to report on Qatar and the human rights abuses and the migrant labor exploitation that was taking place. But please don't let off now and continue maintaining this kind of zeal when you're reporting on the upcoming World Cup, the 2026 World Cup in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. And I listed all the different human rights abuses taking place in all three countries, saying it is entirely important that we continue to do this type of reporting. We've crossed the Rubicon and we can't go back. And I believe that's even more important to say, even saying like right now, because Donald Trump has proven that the United States should absolutely not be hosting the World Cup. As a matter of fact, if I'm being honest, this, I don't even think this is a hot take anymore, but I think it's more dangerous for people to attend the upcoming World Cup in the U.S. than it was to attend one in Qatar. That says a lot, and I hope we continue to report about it like it means something.
Yeah. And I guess to try to make this listener's, you know, just argument as strong as possible, try to add nuance to it. I think you could, you know, there are plenty of criticisms predating Donald Trump about everything the U.S. military has done to make itself an enemy of people around the world. I would suggest one issue that is different in the case of an event like this that's getting $50 million from the Saudi government and your run-of-the-mill WWE events is that your run-of-the-mill WWE events, they are trying to get site fees for them, maybe with local governments, but it's not really local governments who have control of the military necessarily, as opposed to this event, which is specifically for the government at an exorbitant price. That's done with a very specific purpose in mind, I would say. Then that doesn't diminish any of the criticisms that you could raise against the U.S.
But here's the thing. We can say that, okay, that's an excellent point, John, and something, and sorry, Brandon, and that's something that I've made multiple times, but it's interesting looking at this upcoming World Cup here. I'm sorry to derail this to a World Cup conversation, but I think it's interesting to follow up on what you just said there, because Donald Trump seems to be taking advantage of the World Cup as a sort of show of his own regime, as a way to showcase his ideology, his agenda, and his plans for the United States. This Make America Great Again is really being projected through a World Cup that wasn't state-bought, state-controlled, but he's still able to exert that level of control over it. So one way or another, that kind of influence exists. I mean, just a few days ago, he just had a gaggle, a press gaggle in the Oval Office, but decided he wanted two U.S. players behind him, along with a bunch of players from Juventus, just there. I mean, the control he has over events taking place in the United States, it goes to show you that sports really are a significant part of his platform, and he's very engaged with sports. His presentation, if there's anything I'll give to Donald Trump, dating all the way back to the 80s, is that he's understood his brand and what works for that brand. And he's associated with the things that have helped present and project that brand ever since then, from Mike Tyson, right, to the WrestleManias back in the day, to early times with the UFC, to everything he's doing right now, appearing at the Daytona 500, the Super Bowl, right, the UFC events left, right, and center. This is what Donald Trump wants, and he's in control of sports in a way that almost exceeds what we see from some authoritarians outside of the United States. So it may not be.
There are rumors that he would show up at WrestleMania for a minute.
That's the one place where he would have been booed for sure, though. So I guess it's a good thing he didn't show up. But despite this not being a state project, it really does have the effect of a state project in the United States.
I also wanted to get some of your thoughts now that we're, you know, several months into this announcement of what has now been dubbed Zuffa Boxing. But of course, this is, you know, hand in glove with Turki Alşaykh, who has been a pretty seminal figure within boxing going on for several years now, and how you have viewed the coverage of Turki Alşaykh's overseeing of, you know, trying to disrupt boxing. And it seems as though, like, you have this guy that has literally purchased, like, Ring Magazine as an extension of, you know, a mouthpiece for his promotional entities as well. I mean, where do you kind of come down on, you know, reporters that are just, you know, we're covering the fights and what are the big events coming up versus, you know, a figure here who literally, as the New York Times reported, like, there is a wing of the prison for dissenters of Turki Alşaykh.
If you're a person who covers Turki Alşaykh by starting by saying His Excellency Turki Alşaykh, congratulations, you're a fucking coward. You don't deserve to have a pen in your hand. You don't deserve to be a journalist. That's really, I think that summarizes my viewpoints on this. The truth is that Turki Alşaykh is a horrible, horrible human being, right? This is a true henchman for the Saudi crown prince, and somebody who has exerted that influence, that control, that power in Saudi Arabia. And it's somebody who, as a businessman, I would hate to do business with somebody like that, because who knows what comes from it? Who knows where that agreement goes? But he's also somebody who realized that after multiple failed attempts to secure a sport where he can sort of rise through the Saudi hierarchy, because, I mean, he's competing against people like Yasser Rumayyan, right? Like the chairman of the public investment fund of Live Golf, of, like, that's a very powerful figure too. That's his rival, technically. And Turki Alşaykh would have always been secondary in this, just, you know, the entertainment czar, had it not been for boxing. Because really, he failed in the world of football, right? It starts in Egypt with my club, Al Ahli, which he tried to purchase once upon a time. And Al Ahli fans thought this was so hilarious that they chanted him out the building during one of the football games, including lots of insults towards his mother. Turki Alşaykh hated that so much, he actually started a separate Egyptian football club, named it Pyramids FC, just so they compete against Al Ahli. Eventually, he ended up, like, getting out of the Egyptian market entirely and hasn't been back since. But he went on, tried to buying other football clubs and investing in small things. His first success was the WWE, but it was really boxing that he's been able to sort of cement and rebrand himself as this extraordinarily influential visionary in the world of sports, right? And it's because boxing was a failing sport at this point, right? Like, there was a lot of issues. There were still great fights taking place, but the sport had reached such a strange space where the promoters were far too powerful. A lot of the big fights that fans wanted to see weren't being made, and it was easy for him to jump in, throw a lot of money at the sport and make a difference. And now, again, this is the same thing that Saudi Arabia achieved when it purchased Newcastle United FC. It purchased a loyal fan base that it was able to convert into its own fans eventually, right? Once I've seen plenty of Newcastle United fans, they're like, hey, we're doing well, we'll take that blood money. That's the vast majority of what they'll say. And boxing is the same thing. Say, hey, I get to see the fights I love. This sport was corrupt as hell before that. Now it's not. Now I get to see these fights. All of them get paid. Great. We'll take Turki. And yeah, it's so easy to come in. But he didn't just do that and sort of earn that goodwill and fan approval. He wanted complete, utter control of the sport, which is where the Ring magazine comes in. Because once you have that and you have a mouthpiece, well, the prestige you're seeking, now you can present it for yourself. You have your own mouthpiece. You have your own way to tell your story. And that's what Saudi Arabia's always wanted. Control of the global narrative, more than the concept of sports washing, more than anything. It's soft power, it's state prestige, and it's control of the global narrative. They have really secured that in so many ways. And Turki Sheikh's encapsulation in the world of boxing really summarizes what Saudi Arabia has done on a much, much larger scale, right? And the truth is, he's also doing it with elements of intimidation and by just forcing his way onto the stage, right? We've seen, to the point that we've seen very bizarre things like the Saudi Arabian national anthem being played at boxing events in London, England, ahead of God Save the Queen as well, which just has never really happened before. But it's great ways for the Saudi government to really say, hey, we're here and we are in control of this. And it's so subtle sometimes, but they're getting so good at doing stuff like that.
And it becomes a really, this relationship that has to coexist between Turkey with Dana White. Like if you go through the reporting of Nate Wilcox, who we've had on the show, like it seems like Nick Khan is kind of like the broker here, but like you're talking about very contentious personalities behind the scenes that everyone has to be on the same page here. And there may be conflicting visions that, I mean, have even come out when, you know, Turkey and Dana White are on with Pat McAfee and you have Dana and, oh, we'll announce a date when we're ready. And boom, Turkey just like gives out the date right away. Like just a simple example like that. You see two people here who have, you know, they're not used to having any kind of a person that is going to filter them or like they are the final voice.
I don't know if that's... I don't know if that's necessarily true. I've never seen Dana as a leading figure, by the way. I mean, he's never been, right? Sure, he's the, you can call him what you want, the fight impresario, the head honcho, the whatever, but he's never really been the brains or the person in charge behind anything. You had the Fertitta brothers when it was the Zuffa era. You have Ari Emanuel, right, who was in charge of Endeavor when Endeavor bought the UFC, that was the real brains behind the operation and its expansion. Same with Mark Shapiro, etc. It was not Dana White. Dana White's just a figurehead. And Dana White, in this case, is still just a figurehead. If anybody thinks he's a legitimate boss here, he's not. He has no say. He is the figure that Turki Sheikh brought on to add an added level of legitimacy to this facade, to this presentation. But Turki is in control. Turki's floating the money. What does Dana actually have to offer here, apart from his own brand, his own sort of contentious, aggressive brand? He has nothing. He's not floating the money. He doesn't own any of these companies. He's not worth anything special. So it's important for people to understand that the reason Dana White gets along with all these people is because he understands he is second. He's the number two. He's never the number one. Same with Donald Trump. There's a reason why he didn't get a blow up with Donald Trump the way Elon Musk did. Because he might have an ego, but he understands when he's somebody's bitch. And Dana White is Donald Trump's bitch, just like he's Turkey's bitch. So
I don't know if that will be a headline that makes it to the Ring magazine
well,
or not.
That.
We will see. Kareem, as we wrap up here, just taking like a step back, like we've had you on a lot of different times over the years. As we currently stand now, did you ultimately believe that this would be like, you have to look at if we are going back to the announcement of this deal with WWE in 2018 and where it has grown and how they have been able to use combat sports that you've really been at the forefront of explaining like that as the most effective tool, has it been more effective than you believed it could be? Like when you look at where things are today, it's a far cry from where we were in 2018. And I think that there was a lot more of a concern about this. And now it's like, this is baked into the recipe of consuming WWE content. And by extension, TKO that has now branched to Azerbaijan. And like, this is the playbook.
This is the playbook, unfortunately. I never thought it would get to this. I thought that the extent of the type of stories I would cover in combat sports would always sort of, you know, touch on the absurd. Things like Ramzan Kadyrov, let's say. The stories, as violent and as vicious as they could be, they always felt a little bit absurd, and they also felt distant, something that wasn't going to really approach us or encroach on the United States in some way. Saudi Arabia's relationship is very different. It's not only encroached on the United States, but across the entire world. There's really no corner you can go anymore where you're not seeing Visit Saudi slogans everywhere. It really feels like they've just won. And that's a very difficult feeling for somebody like me, who not only dedicated a decade to reporting on the intersection of sports and politics, but relies on some sort of inspiration, incentive, motivation to keep doing this type of work or to keep raising this topic. But it gets harder and harder with each layer of normalization that keeps getting added on. I'll say this as like a final anecdote. I was in attendance for Canada's 6-0 victory against Honduras recently for the Gold Cup, which is the North American sort of football tournament here. And one of the first things I clocked was the fact that this is a CONCACAF tournament. So it's the Confederation in North America. Yet the vast majority of the sponsors were Saudi. There was Aramco as the official energy partner. There was Visit Saudi, of course. There was, what else was there? There was Riyadh Air, which was the official airline partner, despite the fact that Riyadh Air has never taken to the skies once. It hasn't even bought its fleet of planes yet. It's already the official airline partner for something in North America. And then on top of that, Saudi Arabia was competing in the tournament. Saudi Arabia from the Middle East in a North American tournament. It's and nobody seemed to find this strange. It's just, oh, that's fine. Saudi's here. And we've gotten so used to the commodification of sports, the corporatization of sports, that inserting nation states into the process hasn't been that difficult for fans to accept and embrace. You're either dealing with super clubs owned by, you know, venture capital funds, or they're owned by nation states. And the same now applies to combat sports. You pick your poison: venture capital or nation states and authoritarian regimes. So I can understand this exceptional feeling of disheartenedness that people have. I understand the people who email me all the time. People like me and Luke Thomas are getting emails from people saying, hey, I'm done with this sport. I'm done. I can't believe what's happened to the sports I love. And I'm seeing WWE fans start to notice the same changes happening, the over-advertising. There's just small little changes in their product that are going to get bigger and bigger and bigger over the years. And this is, I don't know what to do to stop like this. I don't know what. Thank you. That's a great example right there.
This is the breaking point for most fans.
The Slim Jim table.
We've been watching WWE for how many decades? And well, what is this? What the fuck is this? You know what I mean? Like, what have we got to, guys? Like, it's not even just about the nation states now, but I'm not happy with the products of anything I'm watching at this point. I can't think of a sport that satisfies me at this point without some sort of feeling deep down of heavy disappointment.
Well, I really hope people go out of their way to support Karim Zidane's journalism, because sadly, in this day and age, it's becoming like fewer and fewer people that are covering sports at large at this level of detail. And quite honestly, takes a lot of simply courage to be reporting on a lot of this, where it has become a lot more in vogue to simply ignore these kinds of stories. But where can people go support your work, Karim?
Well, John, like you mentioned, sportspolitica.news would be a fantastic place. That's my personal newsletter and platform where I do a lot of my essay writing and reporting at this point. You can also still find a lot of my work at The Guardian. As a matter of fact, this topic about, you know, Saudi Arabia encroaching in the world of football in the United States is actually one of my latest op-eds for the Guardian. Apart from that, just keep an eye out for news, because I have a big announcement that should be coming out in the next couple of weeks.
Look at that. He is a master of the tease as well. And you can read some of his recent work, including UFC's debut in Azerbaijan this past weekend, titled Blood and Bullshit, UFC in Baku. So you can check out all of that. Thanks so much, Karim. It's always really educational when we have you on, and I always love having these discussions with you.
Likewise, guys. Thank you so much for all the work you do. It's always a pleasure to be here.
All right. That was Karim Zidane joining us, everybody. Appreciate the time with him very much. Before we wrap up, was there any more of the AEW popularity that you wanted to discuss. We kind of went over some of the graphs and such, but just putting a bow on that. I mean, there is it has gone beyond just simply the reception that a lot of these shows have been getting, and maybe hitting a peak with last week's Grand Slam Mexico show that was very, very well received. And you are seeing small increments as they build up towards this All-In show next month.
Yeah, I mean, there's one thing I can add is we can talk about why, but just to reset, TV viewership is up slightly. And remember, that's while there's another option about how to watch this. The ranking has been traveling upward, and the attendance for Dynamite. Now, I didn't unpack Collision. Collision's been more complicated. Collision is not taped every week in its own taping. It's been preempted all over the place. So we're focusing only on Dynamite here, which is their flagship TV. But it's taped every week, and we see attendance climbing. We see viewership up a little bit, and we see the ranking climbing in recent weeks. And people watching in video can see the whole 2-year timeline or so that's looking back on this. It doesn't look like this is a seasonal thing. I guess we talk about why though. Like I've made the argument a number of times that WWE's increases in popularity, which I believe I have shown happened from 2014 to about 2016. That coincides with pay-per-views being available to a much larger audience than they were ever available to before. WWE's popularity decline leveling off around 2021 coincides with the timing of those same pay-per-views, that same type of content being available to an even wider audience when we moved to Peacock. So that's what I'm suggesting here is you've taken your flagship TV shows and you've made them available not to a much wider audience in Max, but you know, it's going from like 65 million homes to like, I would venture to guess 75, 80 million homes, maybe.
If you were, I know this is probably a rarity, if at all, if you were to sit down and watch Dynamite, are you watching it on television or on Max?
I would watch it through YouTube TV. So yes, plain old television would fall into that category. Yeah.
While we're on the topic of HBO Max, I'm kind of just forcing this in there. A big recommendation I would give people is that new documentary, Surviving Ohio State. I would say if any of you have followed like the Ring Boy scandal, I think there's a lot of parallels you can draw. This is the scandal that occurred over decades at Ohio State involving one of their like their lead physicians that was there that was molesting male athletes at the university. And this, it goes into a lot of interesting sub themes of why did this, number one, this was a gigantic cover up. Like they estimate that they did a big investigation into this. The university did with like an independent investigation that there had to have been like 50 people that would have had knowledge of this. And this went on for years and years. This guy was never punished. It was like an open secret, but part of it they thought was just how to talk about, you know, here are these big, like, amateur wrestlers. How are they getting, how are they victims in this situation? They could just beat up this guy. And it goes into the whole culture about how it becomes very difficult to talk about men that are suffering abuse and how this goes just unchecked for so long, and some real damning evidence against some of the officials that turned a blind eye or just outright lied about what was going on. And I just could not help but watch this and think about a lot of examples of how it extends to the Ring Boy scandal as well. And the impact of like power dynamics that people do not understand in these cases, that any of these wrestlers, I mean, they felt like we are expendable. We are on scholarships. Like we were, and they just absolutely, and the shame of it all that these men experienced as well. It's a really fascinating documentary. If you want to seek that out, it is on HBO Max in the US to check out. So there you go.
Crave in
Canada. Yes. That's our equivalent. Yes. Another streaming series that I don't think will be covering the Ring Boy scandal, WWE Unreal, which is going to premiere on July 29th. Netflix has announced for the first time ever, step into the WWE writer's room and outside the ring with your favorite WWE superstars, where the drama is just as intense offstage as it is under the spotlight. They will be releasing 5 episodes, 50 minutes each. This is a co-production of Omaha Productions, NFL Films, Skydance Sports, and WWE with director Chris Weaver. Eric Powers is the showrunner, and executive producers include Peyton Manning, Jamie Horowitz, Lee Fitting, and others among them. So this will be coming out the end of July. WWE Unreal, maybe the best title they could have come up with.
Yes, and as we mentioned, those are producers who are either currently or formerly working for WWE.
Yeah, Jamie Horowitz previously with the company, Lee Fitting currently with the company. I wonder what Peyton Manning's does he just like look at this and say yes?
There's a lot of mixing in there. Like, I think Mike Mansouri, who currently works for AEW in a major role, previously worked for WWE. I believe he was involved with Omaha, with the Mannings at one point. Or maybe was the McAfee show. Right. Anyway, we'll check that.
Do you have any expectations for this series? Do you feel that this will have anywhere near the interest that the Vince McMahon series had? Or do you think this is going to be way too niche to a wrestling audience? Because there is that fascination that WWE behind the scenes, they are leaning on here, that is going to bring people in that may not, like, this is their drive to survive. Like, is this going to have that curiosity outside of your core WWE audience?
I think people in our world will talk about it, but I don't see it having everybody wants Drive to Survive value, but I don't think it's going to have that, and nothing else has. It's nice shoulder programming, and maybe it'll be really good. Maybe it'll, you know, I know everyone's waiting to see just how good Paul Levesque comes off in this. That may be the intent.
Well, that, again, July 29th, that comes out. And let's finish off with some ratings notes. Going back to last week, Grand Slam Mexico was a big success for the company on many fronts. They did 736,000 viewers and a 0.21 in the demo. And this was for a 2.5-hour slot on TBS, of course, not including Max. It was their highest audience since Blood and Guts last July, largest 18 to 49 audience since November. But again, those were episodes as well that did not have the Max component to them. So they were sixth on cable Wednesday night, which was led by the College World Series. So this was a really successful show, Brandon. And it was one that, I mean, if you thought that it was going to at all have like a ceiling, you know, this, I would say, overperformed what I expected this show would do.
It did really well. This is their biggest demo, biggest total audience of the year. What do you think was the draw here?
I think Arena Mexico was the draw, and I didn't think that was going to be a big difference maker. I think just the idea of the show. I don't think one match, like even Mystico and MJF, I don't look at any
Which
one
did do
match.
A good quarter hour.
Yes, it did do well. But I think it was just the idea of it's AEW going to a different country with the atmosphere was expected to be a big add-on to the show, and I think it was largely just the idea of doing this specialized show in a different market. And I thought it was going to be a really entertaining show, but I didn't know if it would necessarily do like their best number of the year based on that. So my take from this was, number one, this should absolutely be annual, and I think you can look at, they have really brought up CMLL and by extension Lucha, that there's a big hunger for it, that seems almost like it's a more enticing part of the Forbidden Door aspect than New Japan is currently.
I think it has to be when you've taken the top attractions from New Japan away and they're just regulars in your company in the form of Okada and Ospreay. Kota Ibushi showing up soon on
tonight.
TV.
Yeah, yes. There you go.
So
SmackDown on Friday did 1,524,000 viewers and a 0.38 in the demo. So the audience was up slightly. The demo number was identical to the previous week, but they were first on television in the 18 to 49 demo, topping out Roy Scheider in Jaws, the 1975 classic.
Have you seen that?
I have seen Jaws, yes.
You have seen Jaws. What's the movie that you haven't seen?
I don't know.
You always complain about. Oh, okay.
I'm not sure off the top. There's lots of movies I haven't seen. I've never seen E.T. Yeah, I've never seen E.T. Yeah. Fire me. So they beat out Jaws. Best audience number since April pre-playoffs, and now they're into the post-playoff period. So I would think AEW and SmackDown as a whole, you would think that they should get a bit of a boost going into the summer now that the NBA finals are done.
Yes. Quick talk about attendance too. Like this was the only SmackDown we've had in Grand Rapids since the pandemic, but they, according to WrestleTix, distributed 10,661, which is greater than any of the other wrestling shows since the pandemic in this location. So these ticket prices are high, but somebody's buying them or getting them for free.
It's just what it is. I mean, it's an eat what you kill world.
Love it.
And then we go to Raw from a week ago on Netflix. 2,700,000 views and 5 million hours viewed. They were ninth globally, fourth in the U.S., fifth in Canada, and they ranked in the top 10 in seven countries, including Mexico, Ecuador, U.K., Bahrain, and old reliable Bolivia. No India this week for Raw. So dropped from last week where they were up to, what, 2.9 million or so?
Yes. But yeah.
Next week, they're going to be airing several hours earlier with the double taping in Pittsburgh. So Raw's on at 6 o'clock Eastern time. We will see if that makes any kind of notable difference. But this would be the first time they've aired outside of their normal time for a U.S. show.
And that's going to be on Monday at 6?
Monday at 6.
Wow. Okay, that's weird. Yeah. You're going to get people to watch it. I guess whenever they turn it on, they watch it. But are they going to watch it to the same degree? If the number is down, we'll know.
Yeah. 2 weeks from now. And they're also for Friday. So you will get it normal on the USA Network at the normal 8 o'clock start time. But because we get SmackDown on Netflix internationally, we get SmackDown at 1 in the afternoon. So It will be airing on tape delay in the U.S. from Saudi Arabia.
Unless you travel quickly to another country and watch it live that way.
Yes, if you decide to get a last minute flight on Air Nord, you could potentially catch SmackDown live if yes. You so desire. But that is all of your news for the week. A thank you goes out to Kareem Zidane for joining us. You can follow all of his work, sportspolitica.news. Brandon, you are fast and furious putting out the state of the business, deciding where the trends are, where is pro wrestling going. You can find all of this at patreon.com/WrestleNomics and subscribe to WrestleNomics on Substack as well.
Yes. Yes. All that is what I've been doing lately. I've been doing attendance reports, basically pulling all the attendance data for each passing week from Cage Match, as well as doing the top 100 weekly TV shows to see. And I think that is a meaningful insight in terms of looking into how these shows, the wrestling shows, rank among TV generally.
Well, catch all of that. The top 100 shows. Does this include like syndicated shows or like the Big Bang Theory repeats?
Only what's available from Programming Insider. So it's only the cable. Well, it's broadcast as well and cable originals. Everything only in prime time.
You can also catch Brandon's writing up at postwrestling.com, keeping everyone up to date. Wei Ting and I are back tonight after Dynamite. Where are they tonight? Kent, Washington. They're also doing a double taping tonight in Kent, Washington. You get Dynamite and Collision if you're in Kent tonight.
Wasn't Kent this past?
Yes, they did
so
Collision.
This is a tape show?
No, they were there live on Saturday, and now they're back on Wednesday to do both nights because Collision is airing tomorrow night due to NASCAR on the weekend. So you're getting, Kent is getting 3 episodes in the span of 4 nights.
Okay.
Yeah. Guess a lot of people hanging out in the Pacific Northwest for the last couple of days. I can't imagine.
And I had to look up where that is. That's like right between Tacoma and Seattle. So it's about a half hour drive from Seattle. So you could say it's the Seattle market.
Okay. And you can catch all of our shows up at postwrestling.com or patreon.com/postwrestling. That's going to end things off for us. Thanks to everyone for joining us, and we will be back next week. You can always catch us Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern time here on the WrestleNomics and Post Wrestling feeds. Goodbye.
Ever get the feeling you're being watched online? It's data brokers. They collect your personal info, your browsing habits, where you live, and who you're related to, and then sell it to the highest bidder. Aura helps stop that. Aura automatically removes your personal info from data broker sites and keeps it off. It also monitors the dark web, protects your devices, alerts you to real-time threats, and more. Start your free trial at aura.com/listen. That's AURA.com/listen for your free trial.
This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. PostWrestlingCafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.